It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll be talking about the differences between rural and urban communities in Wisconsin and what it means for our politics.
But first, we'll get an update about the peace talks between Israel and Palestine.
Representatives from both sides announced that they're relaunching peace talks with everything on the table, even the controversial stuff.
And here to let us know what's happening with this peace process is Jonathan Tepperman, managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and guest columnist for the New York Times, International Herald Tribune. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So one question I want to get out of the way first is the assumption by some people that these talks are largely driven by the U.S., in particular by John Kerry, and that the parties involved, Israel and Palestine, aren't really buying in. What do you think about that?
Well, the answer is that's both right and wrong. It's right to the extent that this is really Kerry's baby. The secretary has been pursuing Middle East peace talks since before he was secretary, as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He worked very hard on this, so this is literally years in the making for him and a big, big priority of him. The question is why exactly the Israelis and the Palestinians have agreed. Is it just to appease the United States, which is reason enough for them to do it, or are they really committed? On the Palestinian side, the answer is easier. I think Abbas would like nothing more than to be able to deliver something to the people and to show, especially that the Abbas peaceful method of negotiation can produce more than the Hamas violent method. Remember, Palestinian control is split between Abbas and the PLO in the West Bank and Hamas, which controls Gaza. The big question mark is Bibi. On the one hand, Bibi has made comments throughout his career and behaved in ways that suggest he's not interested in doing much for peace. On the other hand, he was the first Israeli prime minister to offer to trade land for peace. There is a theory out now that he's the only guy who can actually deliver in a version of Nixon going to China, because he has the right wing and the security credentials that a Labor prime minister, a left-wing prime minister, or even a centrist prime minister would not have. The big problem for Bibi is that even if he wants to make peace right now, I'm not sure that he can, and that's because he runs a coalition government with partners, including the second and third largest parties in his coalition, who have made it very clear they're not interested in making any sacrifices for peace. And his own party is deeply divided. In fact, in the cabinet vote on Sunday, two of his own Likud party members in cabinet voted against reengaging in the talks.
Now, you mentioned that the question about whether both sides were in it to appease the United States. What's in it for them in terms of the United States? Why do we need to be appeased?
Well, the first answer is money. The United States is the biggest financial backer of Israel by a huge order of magnitude, and is the underwriter of Israeli security. On the Palestinian side, the U.S. Relationship is also very close, and the United States contributes a huge amount, especially on the security side, to the Palestinian Authority as well. The Palestinians in particular are strapped for money right now and cannot afford to anger one of their biggest donors.
Just how involved do you expect the U.S. to be in these talks?
The answer is very. Kerry is consumed with the issue. A lot of his critics argue that he's more involved than he should be, given the international issues around the globe, and even within the region, whether it's Syria or Egypt. A lot of people are arguing this should not be what the secretary is focused on right now. Nonetheless, he is. A further sign of the American commitment is the names of the people that he has chosen to move the ball forward. He picked yesterday Martin Indyk, who was the U.S. ambassador to Israel in the 1990s and is one of the most respected American diplomats to work on the peace process, to be his special envoy. He has also named Kerry's own advisor, his most trusted advisor to help shepherd the process through as well. The big question in my mind is not whether Kerry and the State Department are committed, but whether President Obama is committed. And I think it's telling that the president has really been the man absent from this process so far. We've heard a lot from Bibi, we've heard a lot from Abbas, we've heard a lot from Kerry. We haven't heard much from the president of the United States.
Yeah, what do you make of that? I mean, I know going back to former President Clinton, he was incredibly invested in trying to broker some kind of peace deal. He didn't pull it off. Is Obama keeping hands off because, I don't know, maybe he doesn't think it can be done?
I'm afraid the answer is yes. Obama is very canny about not picking fights that he doesn't think that he can win. And having gotten involved in peacemaking early in his career as president and having had his fingers burned, I think that he is not interested in letting that happen again. I don't think he expects to get a win here. And so I think that he's letting his secretary, who really wants to do this, do it for him. And it's win-win for Obama, because if Kerry fails, then it's Kerry's failure. If Kerry succeeds, then, of course, it can be the president's accomplishment as well.
Why do you think John Kerry is pushing so hard for this, especially as one of his, you know, early actions?
It's a good question, and I don't really know what's in the secretary's heart. I think that he has made a calculation that peace is actually possible at the moment, and for all of the good arguments against the possibility or the likelihood of a peace agreement, there are also strong arguments for why it may in fact happen now. And I think Kerry is also has for a long time seen this as his legacy issue, the issue where he can really make a difference. You know, the funny thing about the Middle East peace process is that as difficult as it is, and as many presidents as it's stymied in the past, there's something almost intoxicating about it to statesmen. And I think it's because of the very difficulty. After all, if you can cut this Gordian knot, which nobody else has managed to do, how great are you?
So the prizes are big for Kerry if he gets it done. Now, you wrote about Israel and their the concerns with Iran and how this has been an ongoing theme. Is that going to come up and factor into these peace talks very much, do you think?
I think Iran is playing a powerful role, but in the background and in the following way, that Israel, the game for Israel right now, certainly for Netanyahu, is entirely about Iran. Everything else, whether it's Syria, Egypt, the Palestinians, is a sideshow. But the Netanyahu administration, I think, has finally recognized that if it wants to get the kind of support from the international community, especially the United States, for action on Iran, then it needs to do everything that it can to take other irritants in the relationship, whether with the United States or whether with the Europeans, off the table. So Israel is currently facing a lot of isolation in Europe because of the Palestinian issue. If it can show that it's making a good faith effort or be seen to be making a good faith effort on the Palestinians, then the Europeans are much more likely to get behind it on the issue that Israel really cares about.
So now, whether a lasting peace is brokered during these peace talks, it remains to be seen, but is there any low-lying fruit that you think could come out of this?
It is possible. The parties could punt and strike an interim agreement that doesn't decide on the difficult issues like the right of Palestinians to return to Israel or final borders of a Palestinian state or the division of Jerusalem. Israel could decide, for example, to withdraw from a few but not all of the territories, the settlements in the West Bank, and the Palestinians can make some partial concessions as well. What's led me to believe that's not going to happen in this case is that is how declarative Kerry was yesterday in saying, we have 9 months and we are going to go for we're going to go for the whole kit and caboodle, that everything is on the table, and we are going to get an agreement that takes care of, that resolves absolutely everything. Now, you can debate the wisdom of making such an ambitious statement, because of course it's difficult to walk back. But that does seem to be what the secretary is going for, and it will be difficult, I think, now for the parties and for the United States to accept anything short of that.
9 months on first blush, that seems like a long time to have talks. Can you just tell us something about, I don't know, how these talks will proceed for such a lengthy amount of time?
Well, so a few comments. First of all, the issues are incredibly complicated, and given that they have put everything on the table and that they're going to be negotiating everything simultaneously rather than in sequence, which is apparently the preferred approach, they're going to need a heck of a lot of meetings. The meetings will be held all three of Israel, the United States, and Palestine. So there will be a lot of shuttling around. The other thing that I would add is that these two sides have such a history of disagreeing that yesterday's talks, remember, were about nothing more than the talks themselves. So given how much time can be spent disagreeing or arguing about the act of arguing, getting to substance, let alone resolving these incredibly thorny issues, will take months. And so I would say that 9 months looks short to me.
So we're starting with the meta talks, and we'll go from there.
Exactly.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And speaking with Jonathan Tepperman, managing editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine and guest columnist for the New York Times, International Herald Tribune.
We'll be keeping an eye on this story, I'm sure, in the weeks and months to come. Coming up next, we'll talk about the difference between rural and urban communities in Wisconsin and how those differences impact state politics. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a rewrite of Star Wars in Shakespeare style.
But first, how differently do people from cities and people from rural areas view the world and politics in particular? And is there a big divide between Madison and the rest of Wisconsin? Our next guest is working on a book on the subject. Kathy Kramer's with us. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, what got you looking at this divide between the cities and the country?
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll make it brief. I'm a lifelong Wisconsinite, and so I've always been interested in what people in Wisconsin think. And along the way, I got interested in how people make sense of politics, and that's sort of the thing I study throughout my career. And I was very interested in social class identity, and I sampled a bunch of communities around Wisconsin to try to listen to the way people were talking about public affairs way back in 2007, and wasn't expecting at all to listen to the way people in rural versus urban areas talked. It's something that I just noticed as I was listening to people talk about a range of topics and trying to look for social class identity. And it was a surprise to me. So along the way, it's something that I started to focus on more and more.
And you do something weird for a political scientist. You actually go out and talk to people.
Well, yeah, I know that sounds odd to a lot of listeners who, if you're someone who studies public opinion, you would think that you listen to what people think, but that's not typically the way we do it. We typically use mass sample surveys, which are extremely helpful for getting a good cross-section of what people think. But I've been more interested in why people think what they do. And for that kind of question, I've just found it more and more useful to actually sit down with people in their own communities and just listen to them talk to each other. So basically what I do is invite myself into conversations.
Now, when you go out and you're talking, let's start with how the rest of Wisconsin views the cities. What do people say? What do people tell you?
Well, I'll try.
it's
not
lot.
Going to sound pretty. I mean, a lot of what I hear is you folks down in Madison just don't get it. You don't understand what rural life is like, how hard we work in small communities in Wisconsin, particularly in some of the tourist communities. You'll hear a lot of folks say, you know, the rest of you think we live these idyllic, leisurely lives, but in reality, when the weather gets nice and we can finally enjoy the beautiful country up here, we're working two and three jobs at a time trying to make ends meet so we can get through the winter. That's one of the things I hear. I also hear, you know, you folks in Madison, you suck in all our taxpayer dollars and you spend it on yourselves around Milwaukee, and we never see any of it in return. I hear a lot of decision makers in Madison just ignore us. They don't pay attention to what people in rural areas of Wisconsin want and think. And they make decisions and expect us to abide by them and really don't take the time to come out here and listen. So those are some of the things I hear.
And now when I think about urban versus rural in a lot of the country, I'm thinking the biggest cities. But from what you're saying, it sounds like a lot of people are thinking Madison here and not so much Milwaukee.
Well, it's a bit of both, but there's a difference. I don't know if you heard this term before, but once in a while you'll hear people talk about the M&Ms, which is Madison and Milwaukee. And oftentimes we are lumped together as the two big metro areas in the state where a lot of the infrastructure is and supposedly all the best paying jobs and a lot of the wealth. So they are often lumped in together. But Madison, you know, is its own kind of place as the capital of the state. It is the target of criticism of state government. And also as the liberal capital of the state, it's also the target of a lot of criticism of liberal ideas and policies.
And also as the home of the big university, partly rolled up into that liberalism. Yep. How does that fit in?
Well, it's very much a part of it. And it's a little bit surprising to folks who live in Madison, but oftentimes when people talk about Madison, they're talking about the university and the state legislature, and we're all sort of lumped in together, all of a piece. We're all guilty of turning a deaf ear to the rest of the state, and, you know, we're all a little bit arrogant, a little bit elite. We make salaries that are way out of step, a lot of people perceive, with people in the rest of the state.
And you're out in towns that maybe have lost a General Motors factory or a paper mill, where even then, you know, maybe they had good paying jobs and they're around, but a $20,000 job a year sounds like the best they might be able to get. And then they hear, say, a public employee salary being higher than that, 30, 35 yeah. and beyond. Is there an economic resentment there?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of it is economic. And one of the things that was so fascinating to me is I started this fieldwork in 2007, which was technically before the recession set in. And so I was able to watch these conversations develop as the recession set in and as we had so much tension over Act 10 and after Governor Scott Walker took office. So there is definitely an economic resentment because, as you say, in a lot of these places, public employees are making the highest salaries, and they also are often the only people in town on any kind of healthcare benefits.
That's I've read some of the things you've written over the last few years, and that's a big thing. We're getting paid less than you and not getting those benefits you have.
Yeah, and that's a huge stress for people. You know, paying for healthcare is a huge stress, and a lot of times the way it comes out is, you know, here I am in small town Wisconsin working my rear off to make ends meet, and I work really hard. And I'm working hard to pay taxes, and those taxpayer dollars are going to pay for your health benefits, you public employee.
Flip it around. Do people in Madison and Milwaukee know this? Are the people in the cities oblivious to what people think of them?
Well, oblivious might be putting a little harshly.
Strong.
Depends who you ask, but yes, honestly, and it was a shock to me to hear it put quite so strikingly. And I would have to say the surprise that I have seen in the groups of folks I've talked to and shared these results with is just one indication of how when you live in Madison, you don't think of public employees as the wealthiest people in the community.
And we mentioned Act 10 and all the protests, and public employees were at the center of this. Did this perception shape how people viewed the conflict and the protests in Madison?
Yeah, definitely. So even in some more Democratic-leaning groups that I invited myself into in small-town Wisconsin, people were pretty supportive of Scott Walker and Act 10 and felt like, you know, enough is enough. I've been working hard, paying high taxes, and we just can't continue to give these folks these exorbitant benefits.
And the protests downtown in Madison really took over the city. We still have in the news today the Solidarity Singers at the Capitol. Do you have a sense of how that's perceived outside of the city boundaries in Madison?
Yeah, not not very positively. I mean, I'm making a very general statement there.
Of course.
It depends on political leanings. But among more Republican-leaning groups, if people had not seen the protests themselves, their perception tended to be that they were very disruptive, that people inside the Capitol were very unruly and were kind of desecrating this state landmark and this, you know, this building that so many of us are so proud of. And so they were very critical of the protesters.
We're talking to Kathy Kramer. She's a political scientist at UW-Madison, and she has for years now been studying how people in the cities and in the country, I guess the small towns of Wisconsin, view politics and view each other. She's working on a book on that topic.
And coming up, we'll talk about a new rewrite of Shakespeare. It's going to be Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. And you can call in about the perception issue, urban versus rural Wisconsin, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Kathy Kramer, UW-Madison political scientist, about the urban-rural divide in American politics, and especially here in Wisconsin, how the cities and the small towns see each other differently and how that affects our politics.
And we'd love to hear from you now. What do you think about the divide that we've been hearing about with Kathy? If you're from Madison and Milwaukee, does this resonate with you? If you don't live in Madison, Milwaukee, does it resonate? Do you hear yourself and what is being voiced in Kathy's research? And what do you think we can do to help urban and rural Wisconsin understand one another? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Or you can also go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Kathy, we were talking about how the public or the people outside of Madison especially view public employees. And it seems like, especially with the protests a couple of years ago around the Capitol, people were really talking past each other. The public employees had arguments they thought were really compelling. And people who were not sympathetic to protests didn't see what they were saying as making any sense. Are we just talking past each other in the state?
Yeah, we are. I mean, and unfortunately, we do that a lot in American politics, perhaps in all politics everywhere around the globe. But the perspectives are just so different that, yeah, it's not really about facts. It's about just a whole kind of worldview and how people view what government ought to do and how we ought to spend our money.
Here's an interesting point a caller brought up. Couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to know, is there a brain drain from the rest of the state to Madison? And then how does that factor into how people look at Madison stealing the people from their towns?
That's a great question. I would love to hear the caller's own experience with that. But, yeah, I mean, it's... One might say that there's always been this tension between rural and urban areas in Wisconsin as elsewhere. And I think that's true to some extent. But I think in the economy we have right now, there's a sense of loss in small town Wisconsin that's unusual and new because people are seeing their kids move elsewhere because of jobs most of the time, and maybe all the time, I'm not sure, but at least partly because of jobs. They're seeing their small town businesses close up or move away. They're seeing family farms decline in number. They're just sensing all different kinds of loss. So I would agree with the caller. I'm assuming that was his point, that he sensed that in his own community, that that's something that goes on.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Bruce on the line in Milwaukee. Bruce, hi. Are you still there? Nope, looked like he disappeared. Let's try Liz in Madison then. Liz, hi, you're on the air. Liz, are you there? Liz?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air now, Liz.
Hi, good.
What did you want to say?
My parents are both state employees. They both have over 20 years each with the state. And I grew up in a very small rural community in northern Wisconsin. And I just want to say that my parents are definitely not the most wealthiest people in their community, not even close. I think that's an unfair statement to make for state employees. And now I live in Madison, Wisconsin, where state employees, other than perhaps college professors and people further up in the manager chain, they live the lower half of the wealth in this area.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Liz. That's a perception now from somebody who moved from a small town to Madison.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. I mean, it's absolutely the case that a lot of state employees are struggling to make ends meet, just like a lot of people who are private employees. And that is one of those things that is one of those elements of talking past each other, because sometimes I'll be in a smaller community and people will be talking about the healthcare benefits that public employees perceive. And I will gently, if possible, say, you know, when I'm in Madison visiting with people and even talking with people in my own daily life, there are a lot of government employees who are having a really rough time economically. And that really, it doesn't weigh very heavily, because mm-hmm. they'll say, well, but they have pensions, they have health care, and it just kind of goes back and forth along those lines. But I appreciate the comment.
Well, even with maybe economic struggles for people with that government job, if you're somebody who's laid off from a factory or going mm-hmm. from job to job or working two jobs, the idea of having a stable job with some kind of benefits, even if it's yeah. not, you know, a panacea, it looks pretty darn good.
Yeah. And I mean, yes, it does look good, but I know those of us who live in Madison know lots of people who, mm-hmm. when Act 10 was passed and they took a cut to their paycheck, they felt it a lot. Mm-hmm. And many people had to move to be able to make their mortgage payment. I mean, it's being a state employee is not, I understand that comment. It's not necessarily living high off the hog.
Mm-hmm. We've got Deborah with us in Rice Lake now. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I appreciate very much you putting this program on the air, because I listen to public radio a lot, and it seems like a lot of the programs are geared towards the opinions and the politics of people who live in Madison and Milwaukee, and pretty much dismiss the rural areas, even in ways that it seemed to me to be putting them down. Even the question about the brain drain, you know, of all of our young people moving into the cities for better jobs. And it's almost like people think that people who live in rural communities are less educated and therefore don't have opinions of value. So I appreciate very much that you're putting this on the air.
Deborah, thanks, and I appreciate that you called in, and I'll say we make an effort on this show. We definitely want to get out of our Madison bubble as much as we can, so thank you very much for helping keep us honest. Kathy, is there that feeling that it sounded like she felt like condescended to, maybe, by Madison?
Yeah, I hear that in a lot of places, and to be honest, I mean, stereotypes of rural people are pretty rampant, and they can be pretty mean. You know, just the term, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but the term redneck itself is one case in point. And I do hear people in smaller communities in rural areas of Wisconsin talking about how they don't feel like they feel talked down to oftentimes by people from UW-Madison, unfortunately, or people from the state government who come out to give some kind of program and are trying to connect with local people, and the local folks feel as though their common sense, wisdom, and their own knowledge of their own place is not respected, and that it's oftentimes discounted in favor of studies and university-based expertise.
Well, you're doing this study on how we talk about each other. I don't know if you see a sense of mission here, but do you think that there's common ground that we can find and be able to at least have a conversation on the same page between the cities and the small towns?
Yeah, I think that's what has made me stick with this topic for so long, because as a lifelong Wisconsinite, I mean, I love this state. And part of what I love about it is the way I think in general, people in Wisconsin are very decent to one another. I don't know about the last few years, I'd have to say, but I mean, the Packers in and of themselves. I'm joking here, but there are many things that we have in common. And oftentimes there are things that are pretty amorphous, things like a love of family or a love of the outdoors. But there are things that people can connect on. But unfortunately, I think once the venom of us versus them gets inserted, it's really hard to overcome that.
Do you think we will?
I sure hope so.
Kathy, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's Kathy Kramer, UW-Madison political scientist. She's working on a book on the divide between urban and rural America, mainly here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll hear about a Shakespearean rewrite of a modern classic, Star Wars. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Coming up after 5, we'll take a look at Lyme disease, what it is, why it's spreading, how it's treated, and some controversies.
And now, a new take on an old classic. Our guest did a rewrite of the original Star Wars movie and gave it a new twist.
Let's give it a listen. We drafted our producers as actors. In this scene, Luke, played by Amanda Magnus, and Obi-Wan, Chris Molina, want to hire Han Solo, portrayed by Galen Druk, to carry them away from Tatooine. Let's give a listen.
Pray tell, what shall their cargo be?
Myself, the boy, 2 droids, and ne'er a question asked.
'Tis what, a touch of local trouble here?
Nay, let us simply say it thus. We would imperial entanglements avoid.
Aye, there's the rub. So shalt thou further pay? 10,000 is the cost, and every bit. Shalt thou deliver ere we leave the dock?
10,000? Fie, we could our own ship buy for such a sum as this.
A godly jest. For who should pilot such a ship? Shouldst thou?
Thou knave, I could indeed. A pilot skilled am I in my own right. Now should we stay and be bemused more by this man's words?
2,000 can we render to thee now, and 15 more deliver when we come with safety until Alderaan's bright ports.
Say, 17. Congratulations, men. Thou hast a ship secured, and will depart whene'er thou art prepared. Thou shalt find me at Docking Harbor, number 94.
And hats off to our producers there. I don't know if that's in their job description, but I thought they did a pretty great job.
It is now.
Well, and now we have the bard himself with us, Ian Dosher, that is, author of William Shakespeare's Star Wars. And good sir, we welcome thee.
Thank you so much.
Well, did you grow up with Star Wars? Was it a big part of your life?
I did. I grew up watching Star Wars from really before I can remember. I do have a memory of seeing Return of the Jedi in the movie theater when I was 6 years old and listening to my uncle, who lives in Japan, translate to his Japanese wife in the row right behind me. I can only imagine how he translated words like Jabba the Hutt and things like that. But yes, Star Wars has been with me from the beginning.
Okay, and then there's the Shakespeare side. Where does your love of Shakespeare come from?
When I was in 8th grade, my brother was a senior in high school, and he was studying Hamlet. And, of course, by that time, I had at least sort of heard about Hamlet. And I bought my own copy at a used bookstore when he was studying it. And really, ever since then, you know, I've loved Shakespeare and have enjoyed reading his plays. I was in high school right around the same time that Kenneth Branagh was coming out with his first great Shakespeare movies, Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing, that sort of thing. And so it really just became a passion of mine, reading his plays and memorizing some of the soliloquies, things like that.
So you decided it was time for a mashup, that they needed to meet each other on the page.
Exactly. It was sort of 3 events that came together last year for me. I watched the Star Wars trilogy again for the first time in a few years, and I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival with my family, and I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is sort of one of the early pieces of mashup literature. And so I had Star Wars and Shakespeare and mashup sort of swirling around in my head, and the idea came to me to write the original Star Wars movie as though it were a play written by Shakespeare.
And I assume you had a fever or something at the time?
Yeah, probably. I was under the influence of something or other.
Well, what was it like when you first tried to translate Star Wars into Elizabethan English?
You know, the first thing I sat down and wrote was those yellow words that appear, you know, scrolling across the screen at the beginning of Star Wars. I wrote those as turned them into a Shakespearean sonnet. And after I did that, it all sort of fit in. And I thought to myself, you know, I think this could really work.
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Do you remember what you wrote instead?
In time so long ago begins our play in star-crossed galaxy far, far away.
Nice.
And how true, and now I will admit, I didn't go through and count the iambic pentameter all the way through, but did you try to keep it pretty solid in terms of the verse?
Yeah, it really is. Actually, I mean, and well, I'll explain what I mean by this in a second. I actually am truer to iambic pentameter than Shakespeare usually is. He breaks the rules more than I do. Now, that's because he's a creative genius, and I was wanting to make sure that nobody called me lazy. But I really do stick to that meter throughout the book because partially it was a fun challenge, and secondarily, like I said, I really didn't want people saying, okay, well, he's slipping up a bit there.
One thing you did in writing this was it's not just the dialogue. You threw in some soliloquies and some asides. How did you decide what to add into there?
It was really, you know, I would be sort of working on the dialogue, and all of a sudden I'd realize either there'd be a moment in the movie where somebody sort of gives a look. Like an example is when Luke Skywalker is trying to convince Han Solo to go and rescue the princess on the Death Star, and as far as Han Solo is concerned, that is not part of his job description. And in the movie, you sort of see Luke stop for a minute and consider, how is he going to, you know, crack this nut? How is he going to make Han actually do this? And so it was those moments where I said, you know, there's something going on in Luke's mind, and let's sort of explore that. That's what Shakespeare would do. He would write a soliloquy to explain what a character's thinking and what their motivation is. And so that was it was those moments that I sort of try to highlight.
And you also gave a voice to someone who doesn't have a voice in the movie, R2-D2, which Rob and I were cracking each other up in the office earlier reading R2-D2's lines. And sometimes he has these really sassy little remarks, and sometimes he just beeps. I love that he does both.
You know, that was really one of the gifts of working with Lucasfilm early on. They said to me, you know, go ahead and have a little bit of fun with it. Go ahead and take it outside the bounds of the movie. And that's when I had the idea, you know, to turn R2 into this sort of Shakespearean fool who really knows a lot about what's going on, even though around people or other droids, all he can do is beep and squeak. Really, he's actually very thoughtful and is sort of the one behind the scenes making things happen more than you might think.
You mentioned working with Lucasfilms. It seems, whatever you think of the company, they have been very willing to work with the remix culture and let people do satires and mashups without fear of much in the way of legal reprisal. How did that help inspire you to do this?
You know, I had no idea what it would be like to sort of encounter them or work with them on this. I approached the public corks first. And then they were the ones who sort of handled the contract with Lucasfilm. I actually sort of thought that Lucasfilm might be a little more protective. The first draft that I wrote of the book was playing it very close to the original script. And then, like I said, they said, go ahead and have some fun with it, you know, take it outside what the movie actually does. And that was just huge. And I love that they let that happen with satires of their work, because I do think it creates this richness to the culture around the movies.
Now, Shakespeare is known as the master of the English language. To be conversant in English, you have to know Shakespeare. But is Star Wars, does it deserve the title of classic too in its own right, even though it's not highbrow? Is Star Wars a classic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are just as many references culturally to Star Wars and the Star Wars movies as there are to Shakespeare. You know, I mean, there are bits of Shakespeare that have gotten worked into our daily language, phrases like elbow room and things like that. But there you know, that has also happened with Star Wars. You know, Volkswagen can make a commercial where they show a little boy trying to use the Force on a car because everyone knows what that is. You know, I mean, it's sort of culturally, you know, everyone in the culture knows about Star Wars in the same way that we do about Shakespeare. And I think it is a classic in its own right and in a different way.
Stand by for a second, Ian. We're going to give another listen now to our dramatic rendition. In this scene, Chris Molina as Obi-Wan confronts Galen Druk as Darth Vader.
For certain I have wanted, Obi-Wan, and now at last we meet together here. Our destinies once and for all fulfilled. The circle of our lives is now complete. A student was I when I left thee last, but now I am the master over thee.
Thou art a master, Darth, I know 'tis true, but only evil hast thou mastered yet.
In time thy powers have weak become, old man.
And yet thou canst not win, I'll warrant, Darth, for if thou strike me down, e'en now, e'en here, I shall more great and powerful become than e'er thou hast imagined possible.
I tell thee plain, thou shouldst not have returned.
Ian, as an author, it's got to do your heart proud to hear a quality rendition of your words come to life like that.
It's really a lot of fun, actually. I've been hearing from some people who say that they're sort of getting together with groups of friends and doing readings of the book, and that just sounds like so much fun to me.
Do you have, are there plans to stage this or film it in any way?
Not yet. Right now, Lucasfilm is saying that one or two scenes can be performed at a time, sort of in service of promoting the book, but they're not yet ready to release the rights for full performances. We've received numerous requests from theater groups, large and small, but at this point, it's not happening yet. I'm hopeful that one day I would see the stage. I think that would be great fun.
Well, if it does happen, we've got a few actors here for you. I'm their agent.
Yeah, I can tell.
I'm actually glad that Lucasfilms is okay with that. We didn't even check. We just put it on the air. The show ends because we're being sued by Lucasfilms. So what was your favorite part about doing this, Ian?
I mean, it's just so much fun taking these characters that I've known, you know, basically all my life and being able to imagine what they might be thinking in their heads, being able to reshape their words, to really spend time. I mean, it really is combining two of my great passions, Star Wars and Shakespeare. And so because of that, it was just a joy to write. I mean, sitting down to work on it was never felt like work because it was just sort of immersing myself in both of these worlds and doing something that I thought people would really enjoy.
Got to ask, any plans for the sequel, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, or the inferior prequels? editorialized.
No judgment.
There is discussion about the sequels right now, but nothing is certain just yet, so I'm hopeful.
So if you had to play one person in this play, who would you play?
I'd probably play the chorus, the one who sort of describes the action that's going on. As much as I'd like to write myself into the role of Han Solo, the reality is that I'm more of a C-3PO type of person.
I think the Imperial Army is breaking you up, Ian. Yeah. We're losing you.
Sorry about that.
But thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
We've been talking to Ian Dozier, author of William Shakespeare's Star Wars.
Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about Lyme disease, what it is, why it's spreading, and questions, and maybe some controversy about how to treat it. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.